At 6:20, this is KERA News. I'm Stephanie Kuo. Governor Greg Abbott says the bail system in Texas needs to change. That's after a man out on bond allegedly shot and killed State Trooper Damon Allen last year. Authorities say DeBrett Black shot the trooper during a traffic stop while out on bond on charges of aggravated assault on a public servant. Black is charged with capital murder and Allen's death and has pleaded not guilty. The governor is calling for judges to have better access to a suspect's criminal history before setting bond. The Air Force faces a shortage of pilots, so it's experimenting with ways to modernize its training pipeline, making it faster and less expensive. The program, called Pilot Training Next, relies heavily on a new kind of flight simulator. But as Carson Frame with Texas Public Radio reports, it means students spend less time actually flying.
The 20 hand-picked Air Force recruits in this makeshift classroom all hope to one day fly military aircraft. But as they go through pilot training next, they're spending less time in the cockpit and more time in front of screens.
At like 15, 16,000 feet, it's not letting me start because I'm not at max torque.
20-year-old Airman First Class Jack Pepper is one of the students. He's sitting in front of a stripped-down simulator made from an enhanced Windows PC and video game components like a monitor, joystick, and throttle.
So did you try going idle and then back to max?
I'll give that a shot.
Pilot instructor Grizz Neal coaches him through an aerobatic maneuver.
So he's going to take his aircraft from wings level upright, and he's going to go straight back so that he's inverted.
There we go. All right.
These simulators are a far cry from the $2 to $3 million ones the Air Force normally uses. Each costs about $10,000, and some of the technology you could probably find at Best Buy. Lieutenant Colonel Paul Vickers is the director of Pilot Training Next.
Everything here is commercial off the shelf. I could buy one of these for my son for his 7th birthday.
For example, Pepper dons an HTC Vive headset, a virtual reality platform that sells for about $500. It's programmed to mimic the conditions of an airplane cockpit. So when Pepper looks around, he sees the horizon and a panel of instruments. The simulator also tracks biometric data, like eye movements, and gives feedback on pilot's technique.
Did it say right rudder as you go inverted, or just use more rudder?
Use more rudder.
Okay.
This is all part of an Air Force effort to reevaluate pilot training. The service hopes to move more students through in less time, without sacrificing safety or effectiveness. They also want to encourage students to take charge of their learning, and Air Force Secretary Heather Wilson is optimistic that virtual reality and artificial intelligence tools can help.
It's really exciting to talk to the students as well as the instructors about how it's changed their work. We haven't really changed at all our pilot training for probably at least 20 years. The syllabus is the same now as it was 20 years ago. Yet technology and our understanding of how adults learn has changed quite a bit.
A severe pilot shortage has pushed the Air Force to re-examine its training methods. The service recently reported a 2,000 pilot shortfall, and Air Force Experimentation Manager Eric Fram says the service needed to figure out a way to bring in more people.
The problem with training more pilots is it's extremely expensive, and absent a massive investment to be able to scale up our existing processes, we needed to find a better way.
But with the emphasis on the new virtual reality simulators, Pilot Training Next students spend less time in actual airplanes, just 60 hours versus nearly 200 hours with the old system, and less face time with instructors. They'll also cut their overall training period nearly in half. Fram says that raised some questions among Air Force leadership.
There was concern that, were we throwing out all these lessons that we had learned over those 120 years of flying that were too tragically written, and too often written in blood?
Fram says he's confident the Pilot Training Next approach is safe. He says when the students had their initial flight, they surprised their instructors by performing difficult maneuvers without a lot of help. Still, he says the Air Force is proceeding cautiously with the simulators until it has more data and monitoring students closely.
We kind of have a tagline of sim to learn and fly to confirm.
But the real test will come when students graduate and move to their next level of training. There, they'll spend more time in the cockpit of planes they'll actually fly in missions. The Air Force has scheduled a second round of pilot training next and then plans to decide whether computer screens and virtual reality components will play a greater role in pilot training.
Ready. Ready.
In Austin, I'm Carson Frame.
On Tuesdays, KERA's One Crisis Away project examines life on the financial edge. Today, affordable housing. Nearly half of American renters spend more than 30% of their income on rent. And with a lack of affordable housing, it's no wonder more than 500,000 Americans spend their nights on the streets. Bryce Covert wrote about the topic for The Nation. She joined Chris Boyd to talk about how current affordable housing crisis came to be.
There's nowhere in this country where there's enough housing for people who need to afford it at the bottom of the income scale. We used to have a surplus of affordable housing for lowest income Americans back in the 70s. Right now, there's a 7.2 million unit deficit. So that's really hard to overcome there. It's, you know, it's a game of musical chairs where there really are just not enough chairs. And so what we see people doing to cope with this is sometimes people double up in those chairs. LA, again, is a leader in this, but it's true across the country. People will cram multiple families into one unit or a unit with a couple of bedrooms. People will spend far too much money on a unit for well above what's considered affordable and sacrifice other places just so they have a roof over their head. And then a lot of people just don't get a chair and end up homeless. And we have a very sizable homeless population in this country, considering that we are one of the wealthiest countries on the planet.
How much are we supposed to be able to spend on rent before it becomes unaffordable?
The benchmark that is widely accepted is 30% of your income is the ceiling above which you shouldn't be going. So if you're spending more than about a third of your income on rent, that's considered to be unaffordable or a strain on your budget. And of course, across the country, about half of renters are spending more than that. You could say that most people in this country are spending more than they really should, financially speaking, be spending. And that means they're probably cutting back somewhere else in their budget just to afford rent.
Do people who live in public housing pay nothing for it?
Not necessarily. Most people, I think, pay a percentage of their income so that while they're putting something toward it, it's not going to be an outsized burden. You know, going back to that 30% rule, it really should be a share of your income. So if you have more of it, you have potentially more to spend on rent. And so that idea kind of applies in public housing, but it's never going to be so much that it outstrips what it is that you're actually earning.
Is it possible to characterize or generalize who lives in public housing today, those 2 million units that do exist in the United States?
Well, it's really the very lowest income people. You know, going back to before we were talking about, you know, who do you serve when the pot of money is limited? Basically, the people who get served by this very limited number of units are the lowest income people who really do need it. But I will also say that, you know, the need is so great that it really doesn't make a dent. And there are lots of people who are deserving of it and very much in need of it who are on wait lists or who can't even get on wait lists because wait lists are closed. So we don't have a lot of people moving into public housing very often, which means that there's a whole population out there that's just not getting reached by it at all.
So we had this surplus, as you said, of affordable housing units in the 70s, and a lot of people started moving toward more urban areas. How many additional units do we need as of 2018?
Well, if, you know, considering that we have a deficit of 7.2 million rental homes for the very lowest income Americans, so those are people at the very, very bottom of the income scale, I think, you know, if we added just that number, we would start to fill the hole. But there's people above that level who struggle to pay rent, even if they have somewhere to live, who are spending more than they really should be. This is a problem that's reaching up the income scale that a lot of people are struggling, particularly in the wake of the housing crisis, when a lot of people were foreclosed on or lost their houses and were pushed back into the rental market. So, you know, it would take about 7 million homes just to address the direst need at the bottom, but it's going to take more than that to make sure that everybody has a safe, secure, affordable place to live.
Bryce Covert is a contributor at The Nation. Listen to the entire conversation with Chris Boyd at think.kera.org. It's 6:30. This is KERA News.